Hi, Kelvin. We were
Hi.
contemplating a bit about what you're at present exploring in biology. And for now, I'd like to suggest that we do a bit of this exploration conversation technique. I ask you some questions and you do some of your thinking out loud, because at this point you are working on biology. And you are realizing that essentially the same is happening what you discovered in physics. You have to look at it from a different perspective, but as a result you're also seeing things in a different light. With physics you realize that you had to separate the energy fields from the physical forms, the material forms. And in biology, you're also realizing that some of the models that have been presented in biology as explanations for what had been measured and found probably isn't all the way correct if you look at it from the model of tetrionics. And you already had some examples of the way some of the molecular physics doesn't work. You compared it to you need three trucks to build a Mac Mini in a model as they have it, but you can only see that when you use the approach of tetrionics where you actually build it. So I'd like to ask you to basically just think out loud, and I know this is all work in progress and you're still trying to find a way around into this dance of shifting your mind from what is known in the books to what can be shown by tetrionics. You're still building the bridge, you're even still building the scaffolding for the bridge, because you realize that a lot of what is being said in biology is by inference, by deduction, and it is so different than when you work with this bottom-up model, starting with the quantum and then building matter and then building atoms and then building molecules and then building biology as you're doing now. So I'd like to ask you, well, where can we best start on this? You're trying to find a way into transcode or to reinterpret what biologists have been presenting in the model of, say, planetary system models of atoms, where in tetrionics atoms are based on deuterons. How you've already established that everything that has been found in physics at the level of the Bohr radius and the Schrödinger numbers is exactly what can be shown and produced by the method of tetrionics. You find exactly the same radii as Bohr measured. You can see exactly the same energy levels as Schrödinger described. It's just simply that it follows out of a different model. Not little planetary systems, but in fact little tetrions combining, forming atoms, forming matter, and so on. So in biology, you've realized that when you start with the structure of the atoms as you have already created them, and as you have already established that with those models it fully matches all of the measurements that have been done in physics, so you get exactly the same physical parameters for every atom. It is just that it is not a planetary system, but it's a very concrete, discrete, inert object which is driven by electromagnetic forces. And so when you extend that to the biology, evidently you've already told in so many ways that it is the electromagnetic fields that then are turned into action that actually drive the dynamics and the kinetics of these material structures. But that in biology it is all the more important, because in the biology you have a kind of dance of the material structures interplaying with the electromagnetic field that is not only around the material structure but also flowing through it and also in a way reverberating within it. Those are the EM field, the CHEM fields, and the BEM fields, as it is described in tetrionics. So that is a very fundamental principle of perception, but now you are running into some of the discrepancies where you find that biology, as it is described in the book, does not quite add up to what you find by the construct which you can create in tetrionics. Already earlier you said that in physics there were 400 fundamental changes that you needed to do, corrections in interpretations, but as a result you could show that everything which physics knows is what tetrionics can show. So what are the things that you're running into now in biology and the as scientists would call it, the incommensurabilities, the things that don't compute, the things that don't match up with your finding?
Yeah, I mean, like, these are things that have been boiling around and bubbling in the back of my mind for the last 2 years, I suppose. They're like all the other problems I've looked at over the times, starting with differentiating mass from matter, etc., and then building this model. It's interesting that you say that tetrionics is giving us the same answers that we measure in physics, when in fact, when you look at the picture, or the big picture, as I've done while developing it, there's some changes that come out really early in the piece. Obviously, equilateral triangles of energy, foremost amongst all of them. A different interpretation of what quantized angular momentum is. The fact that once we build the models of all the subatomic particles, you quickly realize that protons are exactly the same mass as neutrons, not slightly less than neutrons as currently formulated. And despite little things like that where I've corrected to give them the same mass, once you use Schrodinger's numbers in the chemistry side of things and calculate for their masses for each element, the molar masses or even the atomic masses, atomic weight, we still get the right answers. So despite what some people would initially see as me doing something crazy in saying that neutrons are the same as protons in mass, just a different charge, we still get the right answers. So as I made these changes, we still arrived at correct answers despite those seemingly strange reasons for changing things at the time. Chemistry presented its own hurdles with regard to the periodic table and the elements and how to get the right molar masses for each element, etc. And that involved me sort of putting it on the back burner for 6 or 8 months while I did quantum dynamics. And I came back to chemistry, and then I just had a blinding insight that it wasn't the Z number for the elements was not reflective of how many protons are in the element, but how many deuterium nuclei. Once I did that, I returned to chemistry, built the models, and I could build each and every model. Their orbitals for the electrons bound to those nuclei match the S, P, D, and F orbitals, and all the other Schrodinger numbers came out and could be explained. But the stumbling block for the best part of a year was this irreconcilable problem of excess neutrons. It just did not compute. Everything about the tangible models in tetrionics, where the deuterium nuclei is in effect a quantum rotating converter, similar to what Westinghouse and Tesla built in large scale to power tramways and cities, etc., to store energy and release it on peak demand, that's all an atom is. But current physics has atoms, and chemistry even has atoms as little spherical balls. Tetrionic shows us they're nothing like that. That the mechanics of, or the quantum mechanics of how electrons are shaped and how they work within the nuclei is complete.
Kelvin, the sound.
The explanations came out.
Kelvin, just the sound just dropped away. Just as we were talking about the tetrionic view on the nuclei.
Okay. Well, just to recap, the despite this different topologies and how vastly different it is to the current model of spherical charge points of protons and electrons, etc. in orbit about each other like a planetary system. Despite tetrionic's model being vastly different, we still ended up with the same results once I had the ability to jump past the preconceived and taught notions of what the atom looked like, how the periodic elements and their isotopes were made. And I just came to the simple conclusion that the Z number reflected the number of nuclei, or the number of quantum converters that come together to make each element. Once I had that, I could build it. I could model then the position of the electrons with respect to these nuclei coming together, and they then match the sp, d, and f orbitals. So there was existing information that I was able to reconcile with my new model as I developed it and applied what I'd learned from earlier tetrionic studies and what the equilateral geometry says must be the case. I now find myself in a similar sort of predicament with biology. The basics are fleshed out in my mind, how life arises through BEM fields or biological EM fields surrounding matter, how they in turn are formed from chem fields of motion, and how all forces of motion and interaction at the quantum level give rise to all aspects of mass energy, whereas matter is a topology, mass energy is the planar fields, the spiritual aspect, if you like. It's the intangible, unseen forces, planar forces that exist around or surrounding matter and exist between objects of mass matter. So applying that, the next obvious step now that I've done the other four books was to look at how I could explain quantum biology. And this brought me back to something that I've been churning over, like I said, for the last couple of years at least, and that is this model of the DNA helix and how peptide or amino acids, peptides, proteins, RNA and DNA are all born from the simple building blocks that tetrionics gives us. I've now done the write-up of the first six chapters covering right through to RNA, DNA, and that's where I find myself confronted with a few conundrums that have raised their head and are proving to be somewhat impenetrable. Mainly, I think, because of the current theory is, as you pointed out, Otto, it's a top-down model. We tend to anthropomorphize a lot of the processes going on. The current model of ribosomes, for example, has them working like little machines, sucking in component parts, spitting it out like a ticker tape machine, while reading the RNA, converting it into the protein that's required. It also has them walking along with two little legs. There's just so many obvious flaws to a model like that when you're actually physically building or creating these compounds and these proteins and these enzymes from building blocks. Tetrionics gives us the building blocks, which are all the periodic elements. Again, all we're doing is combining them a la a Lego block set. They come together through charge interaction, and there's only so many ways that you can put them together. The first thing that pops out as a problem is the linear versus cyclic structures. The cyclics tend to show up in solutions. So we have two models, or allotropic models, if you like, of the same amino acids. One's a linear chain, the other's a cyclic. There's merits for both sides. As I said, the cyclics are found often in solution, whereas the linear chains are the ones that come together most readily. They're the ones that are easily created through these building blocks. And from these building blocks to the RNA, we have this tricky question of codon table that was introduced purely to explain how 20 amino acids can create the huge array of proteins that are out there. It was a mathematical, I hate to say the word, but trick. It was a sleight of hand through convenience. It gave a solution that's now rapidly coming unraveled as I do my work, because as we've discussed at length a number of times, what I've found myself confronted with is I have a model of the nucleotides, adenine, guanine, cysteine, and uracil or thymine, however you want to do it. I also have the model for glycine and all the other 20 peptides. When you go to take, say, 3 Gs to make glycine, the simplest of the amino acids, you quickly realize there must be a residue. The only logical solution is that there's a residue within that solution. But I can't find references anywhere, and I can't seem to find biologists willing to discuss this imbalance. And it's a straightforward imbalance of the number of elements in both sides of the equation. 3G does not balance out into a glycine. No matter how much you shake and rattle and bake it, there's an excess of elements within that simple chemical equation. And I find it hard to believe at the supposed level of biology that we have now, with all our lovely computer-aided models and our huge number of people working on these things, that this problem hasn't been raised or it hasn't been discussed. The only sort of conclusion you come to is that this particular problem, along with a number of others, is just so confronting to the current explanation of biological or biochemistry that they choose to, for the sake of keeping the larger picture intact, namely RNA, DNA, transcription, translation. If suddenly you show that 3Gs make glycine plus a heap of residue, you run into all sorts of problems as to how this coding takes place. There's additional problems that come up in the coding when you build these elements, as into the actual physical arrangement of 3 codons to make the amino acid in question. A lot of these experiments are done in test tubes with huge numbers of component solutions or component nucleotides to make the protein in question that they're searching for. And it's just a numbers game. They're obviously mixing it all together, looking for what they get the most of and saying, well, there, that's what it makes. When in fact, there's a lot of side residue. There's a lot of other elements or compounds that are being made that are just being conveniently dismissed. Unfortunately for me, I can't dismiss them, because being able to build the physical models means that if I take three times of anything, as we do the analogy, 3 Mack trucks do not make a mini miner, which is what we're talking about here. It might make a complete mini miner and a whole 2.5 trucks worth of mangled metal, but that's inappropriate to say that that's the only thing that comes out of it is these mini miners. There's this problem that has to be reconciled, and I've tried to do it via the textbooks and via hours and hours, days of university lectures on RNA or amino acid RNA, DNA transcription and protein creation, etc. And they keep skipping these particular topics. The other problem that comes up that's now raising its head at the same time is the cis-tran arrangements of amino acids within polymer chains, within proteins, polypeptides. It's well known that you can't have them all the amino acids on one side, yet the zipper arrangements of RNA, DNA, translation, transcription, suggest that that's exactly how they work. Well, if they're working that way, then the immediate problem that raises its head is that three U's, for example, three uracils, can't make the amino acid that's claimed, because in the current chemistry models, they're all cyclic compounds. If you try to physically build that amino acid, the three cyclic compounds will not fit. You can fit them as a cis-trans, i.e. either side of the peptide backbone, but then you have no explanation as to how RNA can encode a codon to be on the opposite side of a peptide arrangement. It's 180 degree physical translation. There has to be some mechanism, and that mechanism just does not exist, even within all the charge topology of matter and the EM fields of tetrionics. There is no mechanism other than to say that they're physically wanting to be further apart from each other, which still does not hold water when you look closely at the charged fascia and the interactions going on. So we have a problem with codons. We have a problem with cis-trans and the translation, the arrangement of cis-trans, and the arrangement as to how RNA can transcribe and translate from DNA through to the protein using these steps. Now, this brings us back to the current computer-aided models you see now, where the ribosome just scuttles along and sucks it up and spits out the protein that's required via reading the RNA, and the RNA just, the DNA is unzipped and the RNA duplicates what's the required portion of the DNA to then be picked up by the ribosome. There's a lot of mechanical features that are inherited from us trying to understand biological processes from the top-down view. And it brings in this anthropomorphizing, as I say. We've got processes that just, to paraphrase Richard Feynman even, in his lectures, he was one of the first to point out, he says, look, as much as we have all the lovely formulas that we've created in the mathematics to explain what's going on, not for one second do I believe that the electron has a supercomputer in its brain with a algorithm saying that if there's another that keeps track of all the other electrons in the universe to tell it where it should be moving, subject to all the forces that these other particles, electrons, protons, etc., are creating on the path of this electron. And the same thing is existing now. The idea of DNA unzipping to allow the RNA to come in, duplicate one half, to then move off, go through the ribosome to then allow the ribosome to magically hoover up all these different building blocks that are lying in the cytoplasm and then put them in the right order, irrespective of whether they're cis-trans, even if they're all on the one side and there's no translation, even if that was to take place, bestows a level of communication and intelligence to the basic building blocks of biology that just isn't there. It's all very well, and it's come about through us trying to understand how perhaps we would make machines to do these things. But from what I've seen so far in Tetrionics, that's not the case. And invariably, when I come to problems like this, I find myself falling back on what the geometry is telling me, what you can physically do and build. And then I usually find that the simpler answer is what the geometry is showing me. The trick, of course, is to learn to jettison all the existing information, work out what the geometry is telling me should be going on, and then find corresponding data or information that I can use as a reference point, I suppose, to make sure I'm still on the right track, i.e. with periodic tables or elements. Once I built the basic periodic elements out of the deuterium nuclei, I could then calculate for the molar masses, and I could look for the position of electrons in the sp, d, and f orbitals, etc. And I could see that they all lined up with the Schrodinger quantum numbers to give me the right answers. Biology is going to be a similar process, but the real trick here is obviously it's beginning to look like that firstly I have to jettison codon numbering and the codon tables in their entirety. I then have to find the pattern that brings about these aminos in the structure that they should be. Whether that's linear or whether it's cyclic is still to be determined. It has to resolve the cis-tran problem and this zippering idea. And it also has to be able to explain what the final form of DNA is, whether it is still the rung ladder or whether it's something slightly different and we've misinterpreted the X-ray diffraction crystallography results. And it's the same sort of thing has happened all the time in Tetrionics, sadly or fortunately. There has to be a bold leap of imagination that then has to marry up with the existing information and explain what we observe. Plus, it also has to account for things that can't be explained, all the things I've just discussed. The sad part about this is, with the biology, it's at such a crossroads. It really is the crossroads between the macro world and the quantum world. In hindsight, quantum gravity was easier. But this may be just that I'm just having a real problem jettisoning the existing models in my head in order to accept what the tangible models that I have are. It could be that all this makes sense when we finally flesh out proper 3D models that we can manipulate and allow themselves to interact. And in that case, we can get the right animations and the right software. These building blocks should come together. In the meantime, I've written, I think it's 8 chapters of the biology book, where I've done all the building blocks and I've made a number of corrections along the way there as well. But everything boils back down to hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and the occasional sulfur. But they're the main building blocks. And I can show all the steps right through to the amino acids and the proteins, how they're all done. And I've built all the models for the lipids, the carbohydrates, all those sort of things. So they're all well in place. The stumbling block is this step into exactly how proteins make DNA and conversely how DNA can be encoded back into proteins, what the exact mechanism is that's going on there, because it's never as complex as what we make it. There are no little complex machines going along, churning things out the way we envisage. There's something simpler than that even. So I've been discussing it with a number of people. I keep coming back to the same stumbling blocks, twofold. One is firstly that even they, no matter what level of learning they're at, whether it's advanced or just dabbling in biology, they have to jettison certain ideas, because when confronted ideas like, where does this, all these, are there residues with 3G coding, or is there no residues and it all produces it? Because there's got to be residues, no matter how you look at it. The numbering of the elements suggests that there's residues, yet no textbooks tell you. The second side of the problem is that for people to try and understand my perspective usually takes quite a while, because most people are brand new to my line of thought and the reasons behind my reasoning, because tetrionics covers a vast amount of territory at present. This is just the icing on the cake, the biology. This is the final hurdle to smoothing everything off and making everything nice and happy. So for somebody that's familiar, even if they've just done a PhD in biology, they're then confronted with what tetrionics says about what they've just been taught. And that's quite earth-shattering to most people, but I'm fielding it from a couple directions. Some people are familiar with the basics of tetrionics, so I'm seeing if they can see any connections and see the problems that I'm having. And then there's others where I'm just asking for information back in. I'm saying, do you have information on if there's any residues within the test tubes full of glycine? Is there anything else apart from glycine in those results? The information I found to date is it's just seems like people have been told an answer and they're quite willing to accept that answer. I know that sounds trite, and it's probably not the case, but it's certainly what I seem to be experiencing at present from all the textbooks and references I can find. That perhaps I'm coming into it with a lot more detailed information as to what is and is not possible according to tetrionics. Perhaps conversely, people are just too happy to say, well, Watson and Crick said this is the results we got and this is what it is. It best fits, and it's become dogma since then, and nobody's willing to challenge the obvious weaknesses in the model. That's what I've done with tetrionics since day one. I've gone out to see how far this idea of a simple triangle of energy, how far it can go, where it can take me, and what it can explain. It hasn't let me down yet. I don't feel it's going to let me down now. But as I say, the biggest trick will be letting go of my own preconceptions and my own dogma and seeing the forest for the trees, I suppose, is the obvious answer. I have all the models of all the elements. I can see how they all come together. I now have all the proteins and the amino acids. They all form as per what's expected. The obvious example, exception, is the fact that where we have stick and ball Lewis diagrams at present, with the joins between the sticks, the balls representing the atoms, in actuality, with the lines existing as bonds or illustrating bonds, it's the other way around. The reality is those lines are the atoms, and the balls are just the regions of interaction between the atoms. So in effect, it's turned the Lewis diagrams on their head as well, but we still end up with the same basic structures. We still have the same chemical formulas, the same molar masses, the same types of interaction, albeit the tetrionics explains them all as electromagnetic. Those aren't major hurdles. They're just perceptual changes that have to take place to understand what's going on. But all that aside, we come down to this basic engineering problem of how to build DNA from proteins and reverse the process so that we can get proteins encoded from the DNA. Nothing at the present is ringing true. And that's where all the energy and my free time is focused, is just looking at this from every possible direction I can, communicating as much as I can about the problem and the reasons for why I have these misgivings, and searching for a spark of inspiration, I suppose.
It's quite wonderful what you put together here, and I think that the bridge between where other people stand and what Tetrionics provide is most easily found in that area where we started to discuss the findings of Tetrionics, but haven't elaborated them as yet. You already explained how in Tetrionics you can see how the electromagnetic fields are actually the driving force for the changes of rotation of the electron in the deuteron at the core of the atom, and that all of the colors in nature are the consequence of these spectral lines associated with the change of energy levels imparted into the physical structure, or released from the physical structure in that interplay between the electromagnetic field and the physical structure. We still have a level to explore on the way that the electromagnetic field in the model of Tetrionics creates that entrainment by which the electromagnetic field drives the rotation of the electrons in the atoms, and as a result operates that whole cascade of the spectra, which is actually the amount of energy which is stored in the atom or taken away from it. And in my mind it is a bit the model of, say, the flow of water past the water wheel of the electron spinning in the deuteron, as a result of which more energy is captured into the atomic system, and of course the faster it spins by the gyroscopic effect, the more inertial effect it will have, which physicists know as the increase of the inertia or the mass of the atomic system. And in Tetrionics there is this vast level of description where the electromagnetic field drives the dynamic of the electrons, but it also does that by the interplay of with the electromagnetic surface, let me call it the coating, the surface of the tetrions and all of the larger material structures that are created by that. Because when you look at the tetrion, it is, say, two photons folded together to make a tetrahedron, or if you look at it in a different way, there are four bosons forming a little Ouroboros kind of perpetuum mobile, as a result of which these bosons keep on chasing their own tail, leading to a physically inert structure, the tetrahedral form, which still has the properties of electric charge on the surface. And as in Tetrionics, it turns out the particle and the antiparticle are simply the same structure turned inside out. But when you see that these inertial physical forms, they are 3D, and you call them the topologies, then you can see that the surface of these topologies are in essence the same as the electromagnetic fields, they're just arranged differently. In the electromagnetic fields, it's always coupled in motion. Essentially, it's something that we are looking at in time. But when we see it as tetrions, and as a result, everything physical in nature, suddenly we interpret it as something that exists in space. But then space is essentially something that just repeats itself in time. And Leadbeater and Besant and many others already described the physical system of physics at that level, that we have to account for a level of physics, science, reality, where things are in motion and we cannot measure them, we cannot see them in that sense, but yet it interacts with that what we do see. The motions would repeat themselves, turning inside out on themselves, replicating themselves, which is that what we know as the physical matter, the physical reality. But in tetrionics there is this whole level of interaction between the two distinct realities of mass, which is the electromagnetic field which operates in time, and matter, which is the topology existing as space as an invariant structure. And of course in the biology, all of that comes into play, and we haven't much addressed the level of the interaction between the electromagnetic field and these let's call it electromagnetic surfaces of these physically inert objects of matter.
Particles.
And because it's at that level that there is this interplay of the electromagnetic field by itself, the electromagnetic field as sort of fossilized in space as matter, but also the chem field, which is based on the interplay of the electromagnetic field and the surface coating, the surface charges of the physical matter, and the BEM field, which is the interplay of the electromagnetic field in the matter, associated with the matter, which is basically the reverberant electromagnetic field as it is captured in and around matter. And in tetrionics, we've sort of started to go into that. There have been parts that has been addressed. The explanations of the spectral lines was definitely an opening of that gate of needing to look into that interplay between the electromagnetic fields and the two-dimensional electromagnetic fields and the three-dimensional material structures. But in biology, that is the whole, let's call it the computation, where matter is organized in this, in that sense, that the matter actually becomes an amplification or an amplifier or a resonator for the electromagnetic fields that underlie it. And that's something which I found also in the biology in our living body, where you then see it as a much larger level, that the cells are actually, say, mega structures of material substance, but it is the electromagnetic field which actually determines what those cells can do. And if I can just elaborate that a bit, it is in that interplay between life and death that we then can see that what people call life is actually the software, the electromagnetic field bouncing around in the material substrate. But we cannot look at it in the way that doctors are taught to look at it, and biologists, as a result, look at it. Biologists, in a way, look at, let's call it dead matter, and then sort of hope to find life in there. But when you look at it from a medical perspective, you can see that there is an immense difference between a cadaver and somebody who is alive. In a cadaver, all the material substance is there, all the physicality is there, all of the atoms are still in place in the molecules, in the cells, in the body. But what is lacking is that electromagnetic field, that software that drives it. So there's a fundamental difference between the view of doctors and that of computer scientists, while in fact we need to bring those two views together. Where in computer science it is clear that there are electromagnetic fields playing around in the computer, and when you pull the plug on a computer, then the electromagnetic field will collapse and the computer or the laptop will simply be a material object. Likewise, when we see the same in the physical body, the doctors do not say, this person is dead, the electromagnetic field is gone, and we don't know how to catch it and bring it back. For the simple reason that doctors have not looked at the electromagnetic field, because the Pope told the scientist that they were supposed to leave the soul and the mind and consciousness alone and only look at the physicality of matter, which doctors and biologists did, but as a result they missed out on seeing that the living body is actually a computer which is animated by the software, and that the molecules of biology...
Animated by mass.
Yeah, yeah. And that the biologists fail to see that the molecules that they look at are in fact forms of information. And I like that wordplay of information in formation, because of course in biology you have to look at the way molecules are made and unmade and remade and so on. And that's exactly where I found my interest in connecting my medical training with my engineering training. But when you look at cell division, you can see that it is actually about cell division decisions. And at that level, you can then see that the physical cell starts to become fluid in the change of the molecules, which can be seen under the microscope. But then it is evident that there is a kind of evaporation of the atomic bonding by which those molecules are then reshaped. And ultimately, you can see that what happens in cell division is that the physical matter of the cell and the relativistic molecules within it and the quantum transitions of the atoms must be brought back to the underlying electromagnetic field, which we do not see, but which evidently then has an effect, because when the cell goes from the material to the molecular to the atomic, it seems to bounce back on that electromagnetic information fields and come back at two cells. So in biology there is a need to understand how that electromagnetic field, that force field underlying the matter, is actually the mirror or the energy field or the drive by which cells can divide. And once you see that, then you can also see that the whole biology of our body and our consciousness is in fact determined at that level of electromagnetism, which tetrionics does describe as the electromagnetic field, the EM field, the chem field, the BEM field, but also as the physical structure of those fields when they are crumpled together, forming the material structure of matter. And so tetrionics actually shows that we then can add that understanding of that deeper level, which doctors only see in the difference of people being alive or dead, and which biologists sort of look at as the implied force of life, which they never address directly. Which, however, computer scientists describe and work with, but then they call it the software. And in tetrionics, there is this whole level of understanding which we haven't addressed yet, which is that of quantum informatics. The bridge between where biologists are looking at reality now, from the perspective of basically extended view of medicine, which was an extended view of, I tend to call it carcassologist. I am a doctor, so I'm allowed to make jokes with it. But that was the result of the Pope telling people what they should or should not think about. And of course that morality, that mind police, and that defense of what people should or should not think about has hindered science at a much more fundamental level than people realize. In fact, all of the problems that we have on the planet with planetary pollution, which was created by technology modeled on the perceptive of dead matter, which disaccounted for accountability and responsibility and our participation in creation, couldn't but lead to scientists considering themselves to be outsiders of creation, but in that sense they became scientists playing God, but leading to the results that we find now, that Earth is being turned into hell, for the simple reason that hell technically is the formulation of a closed system, and if people do not allow for freedom of choice, then what you end up with is a science which does not have freedom of science, freedom of choice. I call it the dead science, and that dead science only leads to things which can replicate without any consciousness or any responsibility involved. And that's also why I am so fascinated by what you are finding and describing in tetrionics, because the medical doctors, they know that the physical matter of the body is not quite it, but they do not see how the electromagnetic fields form that dynamic which people tend to call life. When you're able to bridge that gap, then you can see that what is needed is this understanding of what I would call the quantum informatics, which is implied in tetrionics, which is the core of that interplay between the electromagnetic field and the material structures, and which we have started to address at one level when you described the electromagnetic fields, and how you explained how what Maxwell was describing, what Tesla was seeing, what Hertz was seeing and not seeing, need to be brought together in a true understanding that there is an electromagnetic field which has properties in space and in time, but outside of the physical. It's definitely metaphysical, but in tetrionics it is possible to describe that. And you also already described how the spectral fields work and how that interplay with matter works. But we haven't much talked about as yet how the EM fields produce the Kemp fields and then produce the BEM fields, and how in a way the physical particles such as the tetrions are able to do, let's call it the surf riding on the waves of the electromagnetic field. We haven't yet looked at the way that the tetrion and an electromagnetic field can become coupled, and how a tetrion can be transported by the electromagnetic field, or can be preserved in a photon field, which is, say, a electromagnetic field going in two directions at the same time, where the magnetic axis becomes the pivot. Once people are able to see a bit more of that, I hope that that can be the scaffolding by which they can bridge that enormous gap in understanding which we have to live with now, because the Pope decreed that people should not look at the consciousness and the mind, while in the body, when you look in the living body, you can see, as Bert Verveen and others showed, that mind is actually the electromagnetic communication between the cells as part of their cell division dynamic, which I've separately described in my texts on freedom of choice. So once you see that the cells communicate by the electromagnetic field, and once you see that the electromagnetic fields built by the cell communication is actually an electromagnetic field attached to and associated with the physical body as such, then you can really understand that the mind is that level of cellular communication. and that the soul is the integrity of the replication of that electromagnetic field. And in what I described, you can actually see that the soul is simply the whole decision tree from the first cell, the zygote, up to the building of the whole body. And that once you have that in place, you can see that the soul is the fractal, Susi Froebel calls it the time fractal, of the connection between all of the cell decisions in the forming of the whole body. And as those cell decisions and those cell division decisions go on, which we can see because the cell divisions go on, then we also have the understanding that this soul and the associated electromagnetic field of the mind, which is the cellular communication within that system, is an integral coherent electromagnetic field. And as Tetrionics describes it, that is separate from the matter, but yet associated with it. And I hope that it would be possible to help people understand that difference between a living being and a carcass by knowing that, just as Tetrionics shows, the physical matter is inert. It will be self-replicating because it is like an Ouroboros or perpetuum mobile, just repeating itself. But the dynamics of the matter comes from the interplay with the electromagnetic field around it. And that is the, let's call it the magic of molecular biology. Because where in the body we can see it at a large level, we can see all of the cells in the body moving around because we think something, then at the smaller level we can see that it happens in microbes, at the still smaller level we can see it happen in a virus, at the still smaller level we can see it happen at the amino acids. There is that interrelationship between the electromagnetic field and the molecular structure, which on the one hand will lead to more elaborate electromagnetic physical structures, as has been described by Lynn Margulis in her exploration of the foundation of life, or the incarnate light, the physical life. But Tetrionics can now add to that the importance of looking at and the electromagnetic field and the tetrionic material structures, because it is in that interplay that the biology of life can find the explanation for the structure of more and more complex molecules, because associated with those more and more complex molecules are more and more complex, more and more convoluted, more and more interwoven electromagnetic fields. And as we can see in life and death, when people die, then it is that physical structure that remains behind. By the way, in India and other cultures, they say that you can actually take it along and convert the matter into energy, which of course is an immense amount of energy. But as one of my, if actually my first paper published ever said, that amount of energy doesn't have any meaning if you don't have the corresponding amount of information. And in biology, and that's what you're working with in the tetrionics of quantum biology, you can see that the molecules and the atoms and the quarks and the quanta, which take place in that creation of the material physics, is always associated with the electromagnetic fields around it. And I think that it, one of the advantages of tetrionics is that it can show that there is that interplay between the material and the electromagnetic, but I would be inclined to say it the other way around, as it has been formulated in India, in the traditional medicine of India, and also in the traditional medicine of China and shamanism, where it is said that it is not the body forming the mind, but it is the mind forming the body. That it is the electromagnetic field which becomes more and more informative or informed or information, as a result of which the material structure is then made larger because the electromagnetic field is already larger and more coherent. how that in a way it is the particles that are being attracted into that electromagnetic field, just like on the water surface you can have standing waves because the surface of the water already allows for that possibility. So likewise the electromagnetic field allows for the possibility of the crystallization into tetrions, and with a more complex holographic electromagnetic field there is place for more of these tetrions to dance together, which is something shown by Hans Jenny and Alexander Lautenwasser in what is now called cymatics, that in water or in particles dancing on a loudspeaker or in gas flames dancing in sound fields, the same for flames in a sound environment, you can see that there is the possibility for the crystallization of those material substances, and that's say earth, water, air and fire in the examples that I've just mentioned, but suddenly for example the sound on a loudspeaker can take hexagonal shapes, it can have octagons, it can have very elaborate forms. In the work of Hans Jenny, there's actually the shape of the Sri Yantra, triangles within triangles, which are associated with specific sound forms. So then you can suddenly see that sound shapes and physical shapes connect, and that is what I'm trying to describe in my project of Mathemusics, that the cell organization in our body is actually the composition of a symphony in sound associated with an electromagnetic field, associated with a photon field, but manifesting as a physical field. And in tetrionics, there is this possibility to actually describe the details of that. Because what you have found is when you start with the quantum, at the most basic level, at the farthest edge where physics was able to go, and then when you take that at the starting point and turn the whole machinery back and start to build up physics from that basis, that you actually do find atoms which do have the corresponding Bohr radius and Schrödinger numbers. And when you continue that, you do find the structures of the molecules as biologists find and describe it. But of course then with tetrionics you also know that these molecular structures, they have a surface coating, a surface charge, with pluses and minuses, positive charges and negative charges, and that it is these charges that interact with the electromagnetic field, and that it is no longer possible to separate matter from mind, as the popes hoped that they could do to try to maintain a monopoly over the mindset of the people in Europe. But you can actually show that matter is mind, and that in the electromagnetic field there is this whole direct interplay between them. And so I would hope that it would be possible to do a couple of explorations on, say, shifting your perspective from the molecules as you are now describing them in quantum biology, but explore a bit that side of quantum informatics, which is that level where we can actually see the tetrions surf riding on the electromagnetic wave fields. That one
that would forms three form
the scaffolding so that others can also see that it is not good enough to look at biology as material structures which have some electromagnetic properties, but that actually it is the electromagnetic properties that form the material structures, that form the atoms, that form the molecules, as you have already set it up and described in tetrionics. And I'd like to leave my reflection at this. And I'd like to hear your reaction on this, but for the sake of reliability of the recording, I would suggest that we do end of the recording here and start a new recording for your reflections. Will that work for you?
Yeah, that's okay.
Then I'll just hang up and come.
Yeah, I'm like, well, yeah, I'll just add one thing. I'm like, what you've just touched on there is going to be covered in the biology side. What it amounts to, in the briefest, tritest sort of summary, is the differentiation between mass energies and mass matter. Mass energies being the immaterial spiritual fields of force and forces that create motion, of information, of immaterial spiritual life force, if you like. Whereas the mass matter is the same energies in a material topology, where they're inert, they just form a structure on which excess energies are overlaid. So the informatics side of it, and the differentiation between mass or spiritual life force mass and material matter, it covers about three sections in the latter chapters of the biology book itself, so it'll all be there, but we can certainly do a discussion that'll hone in on differentiating between mass and matter in forthcoming discussions.
Yeah, maybe we can just have a broad overview of it, and maybe you could just elaborate a bit on what I just suggested, that for biologists, what will be needed is a kind of scaffolding to help them think beyond molecules and life, and more in terms of computers and software. I'll just hang up for now, and let me come back to you. One moment, please.